Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today says the development, testing, manufacturing, delivery of COVID-19 vaccines in a year from Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca is a feat unmatched in modern science and one of humankind's greatest moments. It's estimated that the vaccines have prevented hundreds of thousands of deaths and averted well over a million additional hospitalizations. But while the COVID-19 vaccine occurred in a year, the foundations of the vaccine goes back 40 years through a generation of researchers working on HIV, cancer, and other genetic diseases. The approaches of using messenger RNA like Pfizer and Moderna or modified adenoviruses like Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca to cause our bodies to develop natural immunity was looked down upon for a long time in the medical research field. But against those headwinds, still, individuals and labs honed and refined their works to the point that in 2020, when COVID-19 emerged, these therapies were in the right place at the right time. Gregory Zuckerman tells a story of the mobilization against COVID and the long story of struggles, setbacks, and gradual progress in developing the foundations of what would become these COVID-19 vaccines in his book, A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Zuckerman is a special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He's a three-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award, the highest honor in business journalism, and the author of three previous books on the intersection of business and technology. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Gregory Zuckerman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here.
You write that the development of the COVID-19 vaccines are among one of humankind's greatest moments. That's a very strong statement. Why do you believe that?
Yeah, I think we're actually a little too close to it to appreciate the enormity of this achievement. But yeah, I think it's on par with Manhattan Project and other scientific achievements in the past. It's not just a scientific achievement. You could argue that there are a lot of executives and investors involved. But yeah, to produce such effective protective vaccines so quickly in the midst of a pandemic, to distribute them, to manufacture them, it's a true feat that I don't think we fully appreciate yet.
Of course, as it's saved, we think the vaccines have prevented at least 280,000 deaths, maybe even more now, averted over a million hospitalizations. So it has already had an effect. And yet, at the same time, we have a substantial amount of people who are hesitant to take the vaccine, or some are outright hostile to the vaccine. That finds us in a really amazing moment.
Yes. Those who are old enough to remember or just have read about past vaccine achievements, such as polio and others, and the country cheered, and there was a consensus that these things were lifesavers and that we should embrace them. And yet today we find ourselves in a position where a chunk of the population, you don't want to exaggerate and say it's the majority of the population, but too many people are wary or outright dismissive of these vaccines. And frankly, part of the reason I wrote this book is to address those issues, in that my book is about years of research, years of hard work, years of stubborn scientists in their labs, convinced they've got an approach that will work and that will change the world. And the conventional wisdom, the consensus in the industry often was, don't waste your time on this kind of stuff. But in some ways it was reassuring to realize that there were decades of work that went into these vaccines. There weren't overnight successes. In some ways, maybe I think we made a mistake by focusing on the speed over the past year rather than the hard work that went into these approaches years earlier, and which should be reassuring for people.
Yeah, one of the key takeaways I took from the book is that while the vaccines were developed very quickly against COVID-19, the foundations of the vaccine are the result of a process going back upwards of 40 years. This is the story you tell in A Shot to Save the World. Why was it important to tell this long story?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I start with the effort to obtain, to develop vaccines for HIV. And in some ways, there's a lot to learn from that effort. There was frustration, obviously, and ultimately we haven't been able to develop an effective vaccine for AIDS. So some of the same people I write about are still at it, still working on it. But we learned a lot along the way. And those early efforts have actually led to an approach. It's called the adenovirus approach, which means you put the vaccine in a virus. It's a harmless cold virus. And that has actually led to the J&J vaccine, as well as the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is used around the world, not in the United States, but is used elsewhere. So I think there's a lot of drama, a lot of lessons that can learn from the chase for HIV. And in some ways, it is, again, reassuring because it shows how the research goes back years. And mRNA, likewise, I go back to 1990 and I start off talking about some really pioneering, fascinating, stubborn, courageous scientists, researchers that said, we're going to try to develop an mRNA vaccine. And that too took years and years of hard work that we need to appreciate.
Of course, a lot of these names, they dropped out along the way as far when it comes to doing a COVID research. Some of them died way too young. Yet they're the people that sort of took this stubborn approach to using messenger RNA, which really was, I guess, very counterintuitive within, you know, the vaccine profession.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think it's important for people to understand there are those who say, well, mRNA, I'm worried about it because it changes my DNA and gets into my body. What I find fascinating and ironic even is that for years, as you suggest, for years, people didn't want to use mRNA in the world of science because it's so unstable and it doesn't last. The cells and enzymes chop this thing up. It's a molecule. We all have mRNA in our bodies. It delivers the message, the instructions from DNA into the cell to create proteins. Every day we depend on mRNA. And people always, scientists always said, well, what if we could create a vaccine or a drug based on mRNA that we develop in the lab? What if we develop mRNA and synthesize it, as it were? And again, the consensus was, nah, don't waste your time in mRNA because it doesn't last in the body. And yet we have people today who won't take mRNA vaccines because they're worried that it changes the body and it changes our genes. I'm not sure what other conspiracy theories there are about it. But yeah, part of my story is about how mRNA took years to develop as a drug or a vaccine. And the challenge was it just does not last in the body.
There were a couple of academic researchers that you write about that sort of were, I guess, the stubborn believers against a lot of, you know, headwinds. John Wolf at the University of Wisconsin, Katalin Karikó, a Hungarian-born researcher, Eli Gilboa at Duke University. These academic researchers saw some promise with mRNA, and they were trying to adapt the messenger RNA so it would be more stable. But what were their contributions? They really were the foundations of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, weren't they?
That's exactly right. And there's a lot of drama that I didn't realize that took place years earlier. And these are all really fascinating individuals. So John Wolf, as you mentioned, he was at University of Wisconsin, and his life was dedicated to children, helping children, trying to help children with genetic abnormalities. And it consumed him. He was very dedicated, both doctor and a researcher. He was in the lab. He kind of would treat patients and then in the evening go in the lab and try to help them, try to create drugs, try to create vaccines that might help them. And he was one of the first people that kind of said, yeah, I know the conventional wisdom is don't use mRNA, but what if we could? And he had this imagination, this drive, and a determination. And as you suggest, he didn't solve it. He made headway, though. And in some ways, the mRNA race is a little bit of a relay race where you pass the baton, and he made proteins. He showed you, he was the one of the first people to show, really the first one to show, that you could in the lab create this molecule called mRNA, messenger RNA, and it can create, there's signs of creating proteins in the body. Now, he in no way created any kind of vaccine or any kind of therapeutic, but it was the first step, and it alerted some researchers to say, well, wow, maybe this mRNA has more promise than we had thought. But again, most people said, nah, I'm not going to waste my time. But as you suggest, it was Gilboa at Duke, and he and his colleagues said, wow, we're working on cancer. Maybe mRNA can work for cancer. They made some headway. They passed the baton to Katie Karikó and Drew Weissman at UPenn, and they really met headway. I mean, their colleagues said, mocked them, and Kariko had a tough time in her career, and she kept losing her job because she was so dedicated to this effort. And she basically showed, she and Drew Weissman showed, how you can change mRNA, just tweak it a little bit, the chemical basis of this mRNA. And by tweaking it, just exchanging one chemical for another, you can actually get the immune system to accept it, to get this mRNA into the body, make sure the body doesn't fight it off, and allow it to go. Again, this is just briefly, it's just long enough to create a protein before it disappears, but it was enough to make the headway. So yeah, my book, my story, the story is really about the contributions of really obstinate, stubborn scientists who ignored all the naysayers.
Those researchers you mentioned were working on a variety of approaches, a variety of different maladies and diseases, cancer. John Wolfe was working on MD-related genetic diseases, but many were working on AIDS. You know, there was a lot of money thrown around to try to find a vaccine for HIV. And this is, of course, this virus has been renowned at its ability to adapt, avoid, work against various drugs. We finally have, I guess, some cocktails that do work pretty well. But against a vaccine, it was really hard sailing. And you tell a lot of these stories where they were trying some of these techniques and they actually made people worse. They had a drug trial one time on a vaccine that actually made them more susceptible to HIV.
Yeah, I find the HIV chase, that effort, just really instructive and dramatic and telling and almost heartbreaking at times. And as you suggest, Merck had a group and they were dedicated to finding an HIV vaccine. And Merck is among the vaccine giants in the world. It remains the vaccine giant. So that's in their blood, vaccines and achievements through vaccines, and the MMR vaccine that we give to our kids, measles, mumps, rubella, that's thanks to Merck. So Merck really wanted to be the ones to find a vaccine for HIV. And as you suggest, they developed one using this adenovirus, it's called AD5. It's a specific type of virus, a harmless virus, it's a cold virus, and they changed the gene so that the cold doesn't spread. And they thought they had the solution, and they got all excited, and they did trials, and not only did it not work, but it made some people more susceptible to HIV. And I write about it in the book, I explain why. And it was heartbreaking for the people, the researchers at Merck. They closed the whole division. They gave up on this approach. And what I find fascinating is, yes, it didn't work, but people have explained, people in the world of science, deep in his labs, they say, Greg, there are no failures when it comes to drug trials. Even when it doesn't, we don't succeed, we learn. And yes, Merck closed its effort, but other people learned from their mistakes. And those people include a guy named Dan Baruch. Dan Baruch is a scientist in Boston. And he tried me. He said, okay, AD5, this adenovirus 5 approach doesn't work. I'm going to try a different one. It's called AD26. And he's dedicated his life to HIV. It hasn't worked. But AD26, the same approach, has worked for COVID-19. So we have him to thank. So I just find the twists and turns in the world of science and the efforts and the roadblocks that go up and how these scientists get around them and don't give up really inspiring.
My guest today is Gregory Zuckerman, a special writer at the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of several books on the intersection of technology and business, and his latest book is titled A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine, which really takes a long history of the foundations of our COVID-19 vaccines, going back to the 80s, where, a lot of the foundational research were not even, they weren't certain, there was no COVID-19 at that time. They were working on other diseases. But what hasn't worked with those diseases seemed to come together with COVID-19. Well, as the virus is found in China, we have a genome of the virus. Who were the main proponents of trying these techniques like adenoviruses and messenger RNA as a way of delivering a vaccine against all this headwind that said that these approaches won't work? Who were the real cheerleaders for this?
So the key players are two companies and two executives at the helm of those companies. The executive is Stefan Banzel, who runs a company called Moderna in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the other is Uğur Şahin, who runs a company called BioNTech in Mainz, Germany. And both these individuals had a belief that mRNA could work as a vaccine. And again, people kind of dismissed them. people thought Bansell himself was an exaggerator. He's got this company called Moderna. He raised lots of money from investors, but a lot of people thought he really was overstating the possibilities, the promise of mRNA, his own company's capabilities. There was a lot of doubt going into 2020. But what I found interesting as I dug into the story for my book is the scientists, the hardcore scientists within these companies were just hard at work ignoring the skepticism, making small progress that you and I weren't aware of. They were far away from the limelight. They were making incremental advances, and it was adding up to the point where both Moderna and this company BioNTech, on the eve of the pandemic, we're talking in January of 2020, they thought they had a revolutionary approach. They hadn't been able to prove it yet. They had worked on it for years, but they were waiting for some big test, some big challenge, some big new disease. And then one emerged, COVID-19, and they jumped on it. And to their credit, a lot of the vaccine giants, and I write about them in my book, they didn't really throw themselves at this disease. They said, yeah, we're going to work on it. Maybe we'll work on a drug, maybe a vaccine, but didn't go all out. And we owe a lot of gratitude to the scientists at these two companies, BioNTech, and which eventually was the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, and Moderna, because they've got this very effective vaccine as well for COVID-19. There was a lot of drama, and it wasn't clear that it would work, but they threw themselves into trying to find shots that could save the world.
In the case of Moderna was, I don't know, I wouldn't want to say it was in financial trouble, but it was not doing well when it began working on this COVID-19 virus. It was, its stock price was well below its initial public offering. It could very well have gone the way of a lot of, high-tech medical technology companies that sort of are there, they're hyped, and then all of a sudden they implode. So this was, I suppose, a major gamble on Moderna's part.
It truly was. And there were people within Moderna who said at the time, we're talking January of 2020, let's not waste too much time on this virus and a vaccine. If it doesn't work, then it'll be an embarrassing mistake and people will doubt us, all the other work that we're trying to do. And even as recently as May of 2020, they were running out of money and they couldn't get it anywhere to manufacture these vaccines. They thought they had an approach that worked. They thought they had really a vaccine that was showing early signs of being effective in terms of tests on animals and such, but they couldn't get the money. They went to the government, they went to different foundations, Gates Foundation, they went to Merck. They said, hey, let's work together. No one wanted to work with Moderna. So they lucked out in that they found an investment bank, Morgan Stanley, that would write a check. They wrote a check for over $1 billion, and Morgan Stanley bought the shares and sold them to their clients. But now we're thankful for companies like Pfizer, Moderna, but as I write in my book, it wasn't a sure thing. They were very close to not being able to produce these vaccines. And frankly, had this virus emerged a few years ago, as opposed to 2020, these approaches weren't ready back then. So we should be very grateful and thankful that this virus, as sad and scary and as harmful and lethal as it is, it didn't emerge earlier. We weren't ready as a people to handle it, and we were, thankfully, last year.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the biggest drug and vaccine makers, groups like Merck, GlaxoSmithKline. They were slow to react or couldn't develop a response. Why do you suppose that was? Is it just, as you write in the book, drug companies like pills that you have to take, statins that you have to take for your entire life, vaccines are not huge money makers. Did that play into it at all?
Yeah, that was a big, it's hard to remember, but going into 2020, vaccines were not a sexy business for most companies. And as you suggest, you take, a statin every day, but a vaccine you give once in a blue moon every year or two, and you just can't charge so much for a vaccine. And often in history, in recent history too, vaccine companies have developed vaccines for certain diseases only to realize that the disease was petering out. It was unnecessary. The earlier coronaviruses, MERS and SARS, people spent a lot of time working on those vaccines. And in the end, it was a waste of time because those diseases petered out. And it all changed last year. Everything changed. And now these companies are sitting on billions of dollars. But companies like Merck and GSK and Sanofi, they're the vaccine giants. And they didn't necessarily go all out for this vaccine. And also some of them just didn't succeed. They tried. They're still working on some some approaches, and there's going to be a nice effective therapeutic, somewhat about 50% effective therapeutic coming from Merck. But as you suggest, the vaccine giants didn't save us. It was unlikely scientists and companies that I write about in my book, and I find that kind of fascinating. It's almost like David and Goliath. The Goliath didn't help us, but the David did. Hmm.
My guest today is Gregory Zuckerman, a special writer at the Wall Street Journal and the author of A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, the other part of this story is the partnership between government and private industry. And you write that this is should be a model for how we work in other types of serious public health emergencies. What can we learn from how this worked this time?
Yeah, this was a remarkable once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-century kind of event in which the government worked hand-in-hand with private industry. We're talking about Operation Warp Speed. The Trump administration should get some credit for that as well. There's all kinds of criticism one can levy on both before and after the rollout of these vaccines in terms of how the administration was prepared and how it reacted. But in terms of warp speed, you have to give credit. They wrote huge checks and they made bets on various vaccine makers. And most of those vaccines have worked out well. And that's just it's not just the Trump administration, it's the NIH, the government scientists. They all came together. And it's a wonderful model. And they all worked. This is one of the reasons why we were so successful and these vaccines are so effective, but also how fast they developed is that historically what you do is you spend years and years developing vaccine, and then you spend time testing it, and then years manufacturing it. It's a process that takes generally on average about 10 years for an effective vaccine. And what we did this time around is we did a lot of the work simultaneously. In other words, the testing, manufacturing. You never historically manufactured vaccines until they were approved. Why would you waste your time and money doing that? Well, because the government helped write these checks and money was coming in, they were able to do that. So it was really a remarkable effort on the part of both private industry and public scientists and the government as well.
You know, I think you're right that previously the quickest vaccine was 4 years, I think, for a mumps vaccine. Cutting that down to a year is pretty amazing. What are some of the steps the government did as far as determining the efficacy, the safety of the vaccines that they were doing differently from before?
Well, I do have to make it clear to people that they did not cut corners when it came to testing. And they were pretty careful about that. They knew there was going to be hesitancy among some parts of society in terms of the vaccine. It is a new kind of approach. Yes, as I write my book, it took years and years to get it right, so it wasn't done overnight, but it still hadn't been proven. We're talking about mRNA. There had never been a vaccine or any kind of drug using mRNA. So they were very conscious of the fact that there were going to be people worried about the safety. And in terms of testing people, there were tens of thousands of people tested before the vaccines were introduced. So I would argue that they did not cut any corners. I think it's important for people to understand that. But I do think there was an urgency. It was an urgency to get testing underway, to get the manufacturing done quickly. The rollout was a little slow and a little bit all over the place and maybe not as organized as it could have been. But eventually we did get vaccines all over the country for those who want them. And they're still available today. So it's important to understand that corners were not cut when it came to testing these vaccines.
I guess my understanding is that, you know, usually when you develop a vaccine, there's, you know, the first to see if it works, it's safe. And there's sort of an interval where there's a deep analysis after the first trial is done, before the second trial starts. It seems like they were looking at results as it happened. And then so they could cut down the time between the various stages. Was that the main thrust of this?
Yeah, that was helpful as well. Yes. Yeah. So there are three stages, three phases, as it were, phase one, phase two, phase three. As you said, phase three is for efficacy. And phase one and two are preliminary. You test in animals. You test for safety more than efficacy. And yes. So while the number of people tested wasn't less than in the past, it was a large number. So people should be reassured in terms of the speed between them and getting them all done. There was an urgency and a focus. And the government came together with private industry. And it was much more, I guess, dramatic than I had expected before I started working on the book, and the people involved were quite interesting and real characters and very competitive and out for glory and wanted to save the world. And the one thing I did realize is that they're not political in nature. One thing that a scientist involved said is when you mix politics and science, you get politics. So the point being, they try their best to try to stay out of the politics.
But what's interesting is you do profile these folks in such a way that we get to know their own quirks, what drives them. Some are very altruistic. Some are looking for, you know, to build their own business, their own lab at their university, or have a breakthrough that makes them, if not a household name, at least a household name within their community, you know, influence. And they're all driven by various different things.
Yes, these are very interesting, colorful characters who are responsible for these vaccines. They're motivated by all kinds of different things, some fame, fortune. Almost all of them really want to help people and save lives. But they're also, they're insecure, they're colorful, they're competitive. There's jealousy involved. So there was a chase. There was a competition. They root for each other and yet also want to be the first one. So it's a fascinating mix of people, very human people, very colorful individuals. And the executives themselves, you know, Stefan Bancel is something of a Steve Jobs type person in that he inspires people, but he also pushes people. And sometimes they can't handle it. It's a tough environment. Early on at the company, people were literally collapsing. I write about in my book, collapsing at their desks, collapsing in the parking lot, collapsing at home just by overwork and exhaustion and lack of sleep. And he kept pushing them. He had this vision. He said to them, hey, one day we're going to be the ones to save the world. And he was right.
One last question. You know, the adenovirus and messenger RNA approaches have worked on COVID-19. Do you expect to see vaccines against perhaps HIV, malaria, multiple sclerosis, or more based on these techniques down the road?
Yeah, right. I write in the book that I'm hopeful. I mean, I don't want to say I'm optimistic or confident, but because these are some of the most intractable diseases and illnesses mankind has faced. But this approach has a lot of promise. mRNA, adenovirus, and some cancers, I think, would be more successful. Will be more successful at handling than others. They were able to turn on the immune system. Maybe they can turn it off when needed for things like lupus, things like that. So I'm very optimistic. I can't wait to see what these guys do. And they've made billions and millions from these vaccines, and they're plowing it into the next breakthrough, the next revolution. And I can't wait to see what they can pull off.
The name of the book is A Shot to Save the World. Gregory Zuckerman, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, great to be here.
Gregory Zuckerman is a special writer at the Wall Street Journal and the author of A Shot to Save the World, the inside story of the life or death race for a COVID-19 vaccine. It's published by Penguin Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.